Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, and welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I am your host, Ellen Jackson, and I'm feeling relaxed, rested, and recharged after a 10-day holiday in Malaysian Borneo. And if you're thinking of booking a holiday, particularly to somewhere different, maybe somewhere a little adventurous, then please do it. I know it's tempting to say not yet, I'll save some money, or perhaps when the kids are bigger, or maybe next year. And I get that, I do. I do the same thing. In fact, we'd not been overseas for 8 years because of kids and work and expense and life. But there is absolutely something about international travel that just puts life back into perspective. When you've been a long way from home, immersed in another language and another climate and another culture, and perhaps if you're as fortunate as we were, you might be speeding down a huge, wide, crocodile-infested river, spotting proboscis monkeys and macaques and pygmy elephants in the jungle to either side. And it really is the perfect reminder that the world is immense and exciting and full of wonder, and that things like paying the electricity bill and wondering whether the kids need new school shoes and worrying about traffic or parking or whether you've done your 10,000 steps for the day just seem so gloriously irrelevant. So I'm back now into the swing of my commitments with a renewed sense of my place in the world, fewer worries and stresses. Even though nothing is materially different than it was before, and I'm very glad to be back and ready to chat to my next guest here on the podcast. And today's episode is by special request. Earlier this year, I received a message from a fabulous listener, Cameron, who said that he enjoyed my interview with Dr. Nadine Hamilton on stress and the well-being of veterinary professionals last season, and he asked whether we might be able to cover stress and the well-being of junior doctors on the podcast. And this is a topic that intrigues me too. So I did some digging and I discovered today's amazing guest who is researching that very topic here in Australia. So at Cameron's request, this episode is dedicated to his partner, Billy, who is studying super hard and, in his words, kicking butt daily as she completes her training as a paediatrics registrar. So shout out to Billy. Well done. Congratulations on making it this far and keep working hard. And in fact, this episode's dedicated to all of our junior doctors who take on an enormous challenge when they embark on their medical training, as we're just about to hear. My guest today is Dr. Rebecca Hoffman, who's a GP or general practitioner in regional New South Wales, a university lecturer and a PhD candidate at the University of Wollongong. And for reasons that I'm going to ask Rebecca about in a moment, she developed an interest in factors that contribute to and compromise the well-being of junior doctors, so those in the first few years of their professional lives. As part of her PhD research, Rebecca surveyed junior doctors in New South Wales and Victoria here in Australia to understand the experience of burnout and its causes. And that is what we're going to be talking about today. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to have this conversation with you. I did have a listener to the podcast who is training to be a psychologist, whose partner is training to be a doctor, who contacted me and said, I think this would be a really great topic to cover. And so I was excited to find you and find your research and to have someone here in Australia who is actually looking at this very thing, the well-being of doctors in the first few years of their profession. But I'm interested to know, what got you interested in this area?
So it was a bit of a journey, and there were a few steps to me actually starting or getting interested in doing research to begin with. So as part of the general practice training, so I'm a fellow of the College of GPs, I had an opportunity to do what's called an extended skills placement, where you do something that's not general practice. And I decided I wanted to do that in research. But doing research in a short time frame is quite tricky because you need to do something that's short and succinct and achievable in that time frame. And then I was also lucky enough to be able to choose my own topic. And so that's when I decided I wanted to do something about junior doctors, because at the time I was a junior doctor. And the topic of burnout itself has always interested me, because a few years before that, I'd actually become very close to being burnt out when I was working very long hours in a very demanding clinical role in a hospital, and actually ended up leaving the role because of the conditions that were associated with it at the time, and was actually the best decision and an unheard of decision for me to do that at the time. Then took a few years out, well, a little bit of time out to work out what I wanted to do with my life, and came back into general practice. But at the time, when I was looking at what to do with my life once I'd quit my clinical job, there really wasn't any information about what burnt out or stressed out or even just concerned junior doctors do and where they go for help. And I really struggled with the what information was out there step. And I wanted to really look at what was happening in the Australian environment and go further with that.
Hence the research.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so can you just, for me and for our listeners, because some of us don't have any medical knowledge or training or background, what are the pathways? How do you go, how do you kind of start your career as a doctor? You go to university and then what happens next?
So you go to university as either an undergraduate or a postgraduate student. So the undergraduate degrees are becoming less common. That's a 6-year degree. The postgraduate degrees mean you've already done something else first. So for myself, that was occupational therapy. And then I went in to do the postgraduate medical degree at University of Wollongong. Mm-hmm. And that was a 4-year course. After that, then you go on to be what in New South Wales is termed a junior doctor, which is your intern and then your resident years for your first 2 clinical years. Then after that, you more or less stream into what type of doctor you would like to be. So you start doing medical terms, so things like cardiology, respiratory, gastroenterology in hospital. You start doing surgical terms. You start doing some critical care, so ICU, emergency, anaesthetics. You can then start doing GP, or you can start doing some other stuff like psych or wherever the world will take you. And they're your non-accredited years. So they're where you're no longer a junior doctor, but you're not yet selected onto your specific training program or specific fellowship program that you'd like to do. The time frame in which you're in those unaccredited years is hugely variable. So some people spend no time at all and go straight onto a fellowship training program. Some people will spend 10 years in the non-accredited space before they're accepted onto a fellowship training program. Once you're accepted onto a fellowship training program, so there's an application process where you apply to whichever respective college that you'd like to become a consultant in, which takes a reasonable amount of time, then you start training within that training program for towards your fellowship, and that can take anywhere between 3 and 5 years. So if I haven't lost you already, by this stage, you've finished all of your exams and all of your fellowship training, and you're then able to call yourself a consultant or a fellow of whichever college you've fellowed from.
Which is what we, I guess, as the users might call a specialist.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So myself, I have been out of medical school now for 10 years, and I've only been a consultant or a specialist for the past 18 months.
Okay, so that's out of medical school. And prior to that, so you said that it's less common now for people to do an undergraduate medical degree, that they tend to do an initial degree, I'm guessing most usually in a kind of allied health
Yes, type of area. Variable. So yep. we had a viticulturalist in our year,
okay.
and we had a lawyer in our year, and lots of physios and allied health. But it's absolutely remarkable where people come from.
Could be anywhere. So people could have done, say, maybe 4 years in an initial degree. They then mm-hmm. do, you said it was another 4 years in the medical training degree.
Mm-hmm.
It could be upwards of, you know, well, up to 10 years, say, in those early unaccredited. You're yep. still really training.
Yep.
You then go through a process of additional training plus exams.
Yes.
And, you know, lots of hoops to jump through
yeah.
before you then become, say, a specialist in your area, an accredited specialist in your area.
Exactly.
It's a long slog.
It is. It's important. And you are learning the whole way. And I really enjoyed my training years.
Mm-hmm. So what are then the factors? You said that you started, you got close to burnout
mm.
yourself, and you've since been researching that, but from your understanding, I suppose anecdotally, but also as a researcher, to what extent is this difficult experience of well-being or that kind of process to what we call burnout, which is a thing in itself,
yep.
to what extent is this a problem in trainee doctors or early career doctors?
Yeah, so there has been quite a lot of research in specifically with Beyond Blue. So they've done a national mental health survey of doctors and medical students, which really motivated and uncovered a lot of these problems and then really started the process of lots of people having a look at this. Who in their study, they said that up to 47% of junior doctors had experienced symptoms of burnout. So that's almost half of all of your early career doctors having problems or having symptoms or stress, not being burnt out, but showing signs and symptoms that they might be heading that way. And importantly, acknowledging them in themselves.
And what are the signs and symptoms?
Lots and lots are actually unappreciated at the time. Lots are then acknowledged in hindsight. So the main ones are going to be things like not looking after yourself, not seeing your patient and your colleagues as human, so really depersonalizing yourself from the situations that you're in. And sometimes that's done as a protective mechanism when you are dealing with quite scary or critical situations anyway, as a strategy. But when you're starting to do that regularly, that can be a sign of burnout. And then things like risky alcohol use or other drug use, not doing your regular self-care activities. They're also different in lots of different people. So then we're talking about things that could possibly be anxiety symptoms like lack of sleep, poor diet, remunerating about things that have happened that were out of your control.
So, yes, the sorts of things. And I know because I do talk about burnout in workplaces for people in you know, usually large organisations, but small and too, and self-employed and all the people who are very committed to what they do, and I can imagine that this is part of a doctor situation as well, very committed to what you do. But if you don't find the balance between those self-care factors, as you mentioned, and your work, and it's interesting that you say that sometimes we recognise these things in hindsight.
Yeah.
They're sort of subtle, aren't they? They don't actually jump out at you. It's not like you have a sore back or there's an injury or something. It's an accumulated effect that starts to wear you down that you only notice perhaps when someone else points it out to you or when you've got to a crisis point. Would that be fair?
Yeah, and they're often progressive in that you're well and able to cope with certain elements of it. So you might be managing really well with lack of sleep or with not doing your normal yoga or meditation or not eating as well as you should have. But then when you're doing something that normally you'd cope with really well but is quite stressful and you haven't been doing everything else, that there'll be a problem.
Gets to a tipping point.
Yes.
And what were the symptoms, what if you don't mind me asking, what were the sorts of things that you noticed in yourself? How did you get to a point where you realised that this wasn't working for you and something had to change?
Myself, I actually had a holiday and then on that holiday had realised how unpleasant I had been before the holiday, especially to my partner and to my family, and that I really wasn't who I wanted to be as a human being. And then I got back from the holiday and had quit.
So that was, it was just removing yourself from the circumstances and an opportunity to reflect. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's interesting what you say about not feeling like you were the person you wanted to be, you know, getting to that point of noticing, and maybe you do need to remove yourself from the circumstances or have somebody prompt you, but it becomes about having that realization that, you know, this is not who I want to be. This is not how I want to live. This is possibly not healthy for me.
And I'm not saying that that's wrong for other people and that other people can do it really well, but my threshold for what was my clinical load and hours at work and pressure that I was wanting to work under wasn't at that level that I was functioning.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yep. So there's a bit of individual variation in this as well. Different people cope to different extent. So what did your load look like at the time? What were you kind of, what were the pressures for you?
I was busy. It was several years ago now, and they probably wouldn't, things have changed. There are many, many people with a higher load than that though. So I was quite regularly working from a 5 a.m. start at the hospital through till the theatre list finishing well past dinner time, plus or minus quite a significant on-call load, which means you could be interrupted at any time throughout the night with phone calls or to come in and review the patient, plus having a after-hours load where you were then having to be at the hospital to review unwell patients most weekends and most evenings. Plus, so that's just the hour base. And then the amount of staff on the floor was probably not enough, in that we were then doing the jobs, which was nice to be doing a job beyond your capabilities because you were trusted to do that work. But that in itself is quite stressful as well. Yeah. It was a lot. It was a lot. I needed a holiday.
Yeah. So not good opportunities for regular, decent sleep, which we know is so important for your well-being. I'm guessing a lot of kind of mental load there, you know, actually trying to keep track of all the patients, all the issues, all the concerns across different domains. So what's going on in hospital during the day, who you might be seeing after the end of that very long day. That mental load of kind of not being able to switch off completely if you're on call. And this comes on top of already many years of training and university study. So is it a systemic problem? I know you said that things have changed a bit since then, which is great. And I know part of your research, or I'm guessing part of your research, is how do we, you know, make sure that appropriate changes are put in place. Is it a systemic issue? Is it just part of what has always been done?
Yes. So I think that's one of the biggest problems, actually, is that a lot of it is how it's always been. And it's very hard to change anything.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone who's working in change management will know that change is very slow, no matter how much it's needed. And the biggest reason, or the bigger reason why it's slow in medicine, is because everyone before you has done it the same and been fine, or been various levels of whatever fine looked like for them. And because they got through it, they then perceive that everybody else should get through it without acknowledging that lots of other things have changed in that time that may have made it either more difficult or harder since then. Change is slow and hard.
Yeah, those socio-cultural changes that have occurred in that same period, perhaps the nature of work itself, the nature of technology.
Yeah, even just how far medicine has come and what skills and techniques we have for treating things that, although are wonderful, are all vastly more complicated and time-consuming, but make the patient experience better and the chances of recovery better, but are incredibly difficult in their capacity to learn and understand and use, but are wonderful.
But it's more complex.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I did have a conversation on the podcast last season with Nadine Hamilton, who's a psychologist who specialises in assisting veterinary professionals. And she said, you know, similarly, one of the issues has been the improvements in technology and the skills and the knowledge, which does make it better for pets. It makes it better for veterinarians themselves in some ways, in that, you know, they have tools at their disposal to help animals that they didn't previously have. But of course, there's a lot of extra learning that goes into that. Yeah. There's a lot of expectation from the vets themselves, but also from their, well, not their direct clients, maybe the pets don't care, the people paying the bills, the families of the pets. So I'm imagining that that might be part of that change process as well, as you described.
Mm. So my mum's a vet, so I know infinitely how difficult that is. Yes, so I think it's actually more difficult for veterinarians because it's across so many different species. We only have the human species.
Yeah, that's
to look
true.
At. Yes, I imagine vet is quite similar to being in pediatrics, where it's their baby, it's the baby and the parents mm. and all of the family associated with the care of that human child or mm. their baby.
Mm.
Infinitely more complicated.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's not something I'd really given much thought to, the fact that medicine has changed. And again, you know, from a change management perspective, as you were saying, you know, change in itself is difficult. Systemic change is very difficult. And if there isn't a recognition of those other factors, that it's not like we're doing medicine in 2019 in the same way that we did it in 1974. For example, and yet perhaps the training or the expectations of our medical professionals haven't caught up.
I agree.
One of the things that you came up with, and I did see in some of the work that you've done, is a little kind of Venn diagram. And I'll put this because I'm sort of describing it with my hands and you know what it looks like and I know what it looks like, but of course our listeners don't. So I will put it in the show notes so people can see, that describes in really simple terms, I think, although I know they're not simple factors, but it's a nice simple way of describing it. The components, these things that you've discovered that are driving some of the deterioration or the risk, I suppose, to doctors, junior doctors' wellbeing. Can you talk us through those factors, please?
Love to. So I specifically wanted to look from the junior doctor's perspective of what their experiences were with stress and burnout. So more at an individual personal level rather than a whole picture or big picture, because I believe that had been done on a bigger level. And there hadn't been research on the Australian individual perspective, because it is different all around the world with different processes and hospital systems and training systems. But specifically having a look at the Australian junior doctor experience, and I was wanting to have a look at both the hospital-based trainees and the general practice-based trainees to see whether or not there was any difference in what their stress and burnout looked like. And quite surprising to me, I'd identified that there was no difference between general practice or hospital-based junior doctors, that they both experienced stress and burnout in the same ways and with similar causative factors, and that then replicated to how they felt in quite similar experiences as well. The Venn diagram that you're talking about and the three components of that actually is expectations of self, so how the junior doctor has expectations and beliefs of what they should and shouldn't be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is expectations and response from others, so what other people's or other forces' expectations on them are and what happens when they're not quite aligned, and then self-care.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm happy to talk through each one of those.
Yeah, let's unpack those a little bit. Let's start with the expectations of self, because that's one of my favourite topics in psychology too.
So expectations of self looked like when junior doctors were aware of their skills and aware of their abilities, and they usually, you know, or you should intuitively know what you're comfortable with and not what you're not comfortable with, or you get a gut feeling of when you're just not comfortable doing something that you've been asked to do. And then specifically when you go into a situation where you're asked to do something beyond that. So that could be something as simple as discussing with a patient or a family member what the surgery they were about to go through entailed, when you yourself have never done that surgery before.
So just feeling out of your depth or out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, exactly. Or even putting a cannula in someone, so a device to deliver fluids and take bloods directly into the vein that you haven't done before or you know is a particularly difficult patient to do that in. Huge range further than that of when you might be operating outside of your expectations. But in the medical field, quite often you don't know what you're expected to know or don't know what is coming at you until it arrives. And it's only then that you really are able to say, yes, I'm comfortable and familiar with this, or no, I'm not. And that step of then asking for help or acknowledging that it's not something you're comfortable with is where the stress and the burnout happens.
So that's the sticking point. It's not so much that you're expected to do things. It's your own expectations of, I shouldn't have to ask for help for this, or I should know how to do this, or I should feel comfortable with it.
Yes, and I think more than that, so then the shoulds, which I don't like that as a word anyway.
No, not a healthy word.
So the belief that everybody else knows how to do it and you don't, and therefore you're not as good or as capable as everybody else, which usually is untrue. And then also identifying that there's a gap in your skill set that you may not have been aware was even there before until that had come. And as doctors, quite often we're perfectionists and want to be able to do everything and want to be good at everything we're doing. And then especially in your junior doctor years, to constantly be barraged by things that you can't do and don't know how to do is very stressful for lots of junior doctors.
Yeah, and I've often thought about this because I thought it's not dissimilar. I think the situations are slightly, well, they are different, but for psychologists as well, that I think a lot of people who, by the time you've got through your training, you know, you're often people, and I'd say this would be even more enhanced for perhaps doctors because you've always been good at all your academic stuff. You know, you had to do really well at school to get into the degree in the first place. And then you've got a whole lot of people who are all have those high expectations of themselves who go through training together, and that kind of amps it all up a bit. So that perfectionism, that expectation of yourself that you should be able to do everything, that if you're confused or uncertain or thrown into a situation that you don't feel really comfortable with, it's the unhelpful thinking perhaps that goes around that. But I can imagine that part of it is the system that you've kind of grown up in, that cohort of people who are all similar, and so it all kind of amps it all up a little more and a little more.
Exactly. You've often come from a background where you've been one of the smartest at school and one of the best at your extracurricular activities and excelled in your small or regional town or even in your capital city and done really well at a school level and then at an undergraduate level and then usually at a medical school level. And then to be starting right back from the bottom again is quite difficult once you've already achieved so much, and yet all of that is then meaningless.
So confronting, I'm guessing.
Yes, it can be.
Okay, so that's one component, this expectation of ourselves. Then you talk about the expectations that others have.
Yeah, so this is more talking about what the junior doctors are expecting when they're going into a term or into a situation or into any discussion or conversation that they're having. And I guess what the junior doctors as themselves, when I interviewed them, largely expected or hoped is that they would be safe and well supported and they would be knowledgeable and able to go into an environment and do well and succeed in it. And so whether or not that's a realistic expectation already is something that can be further pulls apart. But they were hoping that even if they did have struggles, that there would be someone there that could guide and support them. And that largely does happen. And largely when you're in a situation that you've not been in before, there'll be a more senior doctor or somebody else that can take you by the hand and say, don't worry, let's do this together. But that doesn't always happen, particularly after hours and when you're in a poorly staffed area or location and you've got to call someone in from a different location and acknowledge that you're not comfortable and you need them to come in from wherever they are at that time, be it a different hospital or from their home looking after their children, to come and help you with a situation you're not comfortable with. And it's seen that when your expectations are met and when there's been no problems and the response of others has been good, that there's no issues, that everyone does really well and succeeds and learns and moves on together. But when there are issues, so when they don't have that backup support or they make the phone call and whoever they're calling is either doesn't answer or is non-responsive or is on call or is stuck doing something else themselves, or they're told that they should be able to do a skill that they can't, or just try yourself, or whatever variation of lack of support they have, that then there's big barriers there, big barriers to their stress, clearly, and then leading rapidly into burnout.
So, I mean, it's from the sounds of things, it's positive in some regards in that there is usually somebody there who is willing to help, but it's whether they're available. Are there ever situations where people, because I can imagine particularly perhaps for senior doctors, like all of us, you know, it's hard to remember what it was like when you were starting out. You kind of forget that not everyone knows everything or that they're comfortable with everything. And I can imagine there would certainly be situations where you might ask for the support or not even feel comfortable asking for the support because you don't feel safe in that regard, you know, from psychological safety, you know, you just don't know what kind of response you're going to get from that other more senior doctor.
Mm. So there is actually a wonderful article written up in the MJA, the Medical Journal of Australia, last year, looking at that. So calling on seniors to be more of a mentor and a colleague to junior doctors. And because it takes such a long time to go from being a junior doctor to being a senior or a late, mid to late career doctor, in 10 years' time, you've completely forgotten, or longer, 20 years, what it was since when you were there. And you've enormously changed as a human being in that time as well. So what you're able to cope with and manage is vastly different on multiple levels. And it is difficult to remember what you were like as a human and forgive yourself for what you were like as a human 10 years ago.
Yeah, again, all those complicated thinking factors, aren't they? That kind of expectation of self, what others expect from you. Can I call them? Should I call them? Do I need to call them? You know, uncertainty, which we know is just stressful for human beings, being placed in a situation of uncertainty.
Yes.
So that's self-expectation and expectation and response from others or of others. Where does the self-care piece fit in?
So self-care is vastly important for stress and for burnout and is really the protective factor amongst everything else. And as a whole, doctors are actually really good at self-care when they're doing well as when they're not doing well. And they were all aware that they needed to have good self-care and they all understood what that looked like. So it looked like exercising regularly, eating regular meals that have a good nutrition in them and some variation on meditation or time for self or being able to get away from the situation that they were in. And that specifically an interest of me was that those with family or dependents were actually better at self-care and better at prioritizing that life in the work-life balance than those without. And so self-care really looks like at what those protective factors are to be able to deal with the ongoing stresses that you have in your work life.
Mm-hmm. And I know, and I've been through this myself, but I know a lot of other people do too. Sometimes self-care, we know we should do it. It's a cognitive thing, you know, we know logically we should do it, but the doing of it becomes the issue. We tend to prioritize it last. Or, you know, there's quite a mindset shift, I think. And maybe it's interesting you say that about people with dependents or people perhaps who are looking after children. Maybe that's easier to make that mindset shift because you realise that you need to be okay to look after them, or it's a change in priorities or change in values. I don't know. I hadn't really thought much about it. But I do know that there is a shift that we need to go through, and perhaps sometimes it gets to when we get to burnout or some kind of crisis point before we realise that this is not just an academic exercise. You know, self-care really is the doing of it.
And that's actually interesting you've said that, because that's now where my PhD has probably moved more towards, is I'm now having a look at motherhood in medicine and the barriers and supports that specifically doctors who are mums have around juggling the doctor role and the mother role. And I might have to talk to you about that another time.
Yeah, that might be another whole conversation, mightn't it? Because you are a mother yourself. You have two little people.
I do.
Yeah, I could see where that would start to lead you down that path, because it is another, well, it is another conversation, but it's a whole new perspective on life, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Okay, so, and it was interesting that you say that, you know, junior, because I was kind of imagining being a junior doctor. I suppose those early years in any career, I know for me, when I finally finished studying after many years and I had a job, and you're also, you're indestructible, you think you're indestructible. You know, you're not really paying attention to things like self-care. You party and you have fun and you probably don't get enough sleep. So do you think, is that part of this as well, that the age group perhaps who are going through it, does that compound it?
Not as much as I think it may have previously, and just because so many are postgraduates now.
Okay.
And so the age when you're finishing medicine is often your late 20s, early 30s.
Rather, so you might have got over a bit of that stuff by then.
Exactly, your early 20s. So that probably is a much bigger problem during medical school than after. And I honestly think that most people don't have enough time to pick up their phone, to call a colleague, to ask them to have a drink,
yep,
then to go out socialising, which in itself is a problem.
Yeah. Socialising is quite a, well, it is, you know, maintaining social connections really important to our well-being. So perhaps that's actually dropping away as a consequence of the working hours and the expectations and the system itself.
And the postgraduate studies, in that people at that age want families or have families and are going to be using their supports outside of the hospital system rather than within the hospital system.
Mm. Okay, so these three different components which are having an effect. And I know I did read something that in one of the press articles around your PhD work that not everybody has these struggles. There are some people for whom they're still able to not just survive but thrive through these challenges. What makes the difference as far as you know at this stage?
So it's probably beyond what I've looked at. I think it comes down to that everybody is different, and what everybody does well in and excels in is different for each individual, and what their capabilities are is different. And that's not saying that someone who gets burnt out isn't capable. It's just that the scenarios around that meant that at that point in time they were struggling, whereas another person in that situation will have different skills and different abilities and different life experiences that will mean they actually enjoy that stress that they're put under. But I think that's really nice about what humans are and what colleagues and doctors are, is that we're all different and we all bring unique and different experiences into it. And that's why I guess the medical field is so broad and what we can go into is so variable, that we all we end up choosing where we fall quite well most of the time.
It can help to direct the pathway or the place that's best suited for you.
Hopefully, yes.
Yep. As best we can ever know these things. It's all an adventure.
Yeah.
And it's interesting you said that about those kind of individual, and I can sort of imagine that, you know, there'll be individual factors. There'll also be other life factors that are going on for people. I know when I'm talking about resilience in the workplace is that, you know, the same event can affect so many different people in different ways, and even affect the same person in different ways depending on what else is going on in their lives. So there might be personality factors, but there might also be that things are difficult at home, or they're managing a whole other set of factors in their life that also impinge on our ability to be resilient at that point in time.
Yeah.
People are complex and lives are complex. And as you say, I mean, 47%, if that statistic is accurate, you know, it's almost, it's half, isn't it, effectively, close enough?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, well, that might be another conversation once you've kind of pulled out some of those surviving and thriving, or the thriving factors.
It's amazing how much research just asks more questions.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's the fun part of it. We need to find out more. Now we need to look at this. Now we need to look at that.
Exactly.
We talked about, obviously, there's risk to individuals in this situation. You know, we don't want people burning out. We don't want people, you know, and the risk with burnout is that once it gets beyond burnout, we're starting to look at clinical illness, often anxiety and depression, probably the most common. So we don't want that happening to anybody. But what are the kind of further risks. If we've got doctors who are really operating not at their best because they're stressed.
So further risks are usually split into personal and professional risks. And the personal risks are the ones that you describe. So that burnout links to anxiety and depression and then can link to the suicide or suicidal intent, specifically in doctors or in all people. And then the professional group is that junior doctors who report or are reported to be burnt out are more likely to be absent for work, more likely to have depression, have self-reported medical errors, so have made clinical decisions that may not be correct or have made clerical errors that shouldn't have been made, and then are more likely to engage in risky behaviours such as increased alcohol or other drug use.
So it extends beyond just the individual to errors in their work, which obviously then potentially puts other people at risk.
Which is why it's so important.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's being done? I mean, you're researching, which is fantastic. So you're contributing to the knowledge in the field. What else is being done? Is, you know, to what extent is this being recognised as an issue, and to what extent are things starting to change perhaps?
So the recognition has really largely been media driven, which has been wonderful. Once the media picks something up, it tends to run with it for quite a while. So there was unfortunately quite a few high profile medical suicides over the past 2 years that really then have been pushed by their family to try and show how much of a problem this is, which is very difficult for the family to do, but they've really opened up a lot of conversations about specifically junior doctor burnout, which also then once the media is involved means that people who can make decisions, politicians and such, hear that this is a problem and are more likely to devote their busy time and lives to making decisions and setting policies. But all of this still takes time. So there has been some funding at a state level and at a federal level looking at junior doctors and at burnout. And there have been some specific programs placed in individual hospitals looking at training and education. And specifically last year, some sites were de-accredited, which means that they can no longer take trainees at that site because they were deemed as being dangerous for the trainee. Mm-hmm. And that was specifically due to poor work conditions at that site.
Okay, so change is starting to happen at a multiple at multiple levels there. So within organisations, within education and training, within policy, and then even socially, I suppose, once the media gets involved. Even the fact that you and I are having this conversation and that you're doing the research is a sign that there is recognition of the problem, which is always the first step in any kind of change, recognition that there is an issue, and then starting to look more proactively at what we can do about it.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, that is promising positive news, although I'm guessing from your point of view, there's still probably a long way to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what about the individuals themselves? What is it that if we've got junior doctors listening or people perhaps who are currently studying and looking at a career in medicine, what is it that at the individual level people really need to be doing in order to thrive, not just survive?
So my big one that I talk to medical students or junior doctors about is asking for help. So acknowledging that it's okay not to be comfortable or familiar in a situation and really getting rid of that barrier of response from others and what your expectations of self are and expecting that you're going to be uncomfortable and unable to do things because you are just at the very beginning of a career. And although your medical schooling is training you to be an expert, they're training you to be an expert in a field that is going to change and you're really not an expert in at any level, and that you really need to be able to and be taught how to ask for help and to have those difficult conversations, often with potentially difficult people in challenging situations, and be comfortable doing that.
So conversations, asking for help, which is, again, it's, I suppose in psychology we'd refer to as kind of having self-efficacy, that kind of belief that I can, that it's okay to ask for help, that it isn't a sign that you're not good enough or you don't know stuff that you should know or that you're, you know, in inverted commas, failing in some
Absolutely.
Ways.
Yes.
That it's that it's very much part of, this is all brand new, it's like you're starting all over again, that's okay, everybody knows and understands, and it's up to you to take action for your own well-being, and I guess even reframing it, you know, from the point of view of your patient's well-being.
And even if it's not brand new and you've done it 1,000 times before, there's components or situations about that that may be challenging in that location, that you're under-resourced or you don't have the equipment you're used to, or it's a particularly unwell patient or particularly demanding scenario, and that's going to put you outside of your comfort zone in something that you're very comfortable with. And that's, I guess, what is wonderful about medicine, is that it's changing but often quite uncomfortable at the same time.
Yeah, is it about having recognition of that? You know, I'm sort of thinking in systems terms around, you know, you're operating in a system that even if you know what you're doing and you've done it 1,000 times before, that system, that container that you're operating in, that you're working within, is changing all the time. You may never have the same 2 sets of circumstances.
Absolutely.
Okay, that does make sense. It sounds very challenging, but it does make sense in the context of, you know, the importance of understanding those things to get people to then ask for help. What else do the individuals need to be doing?
So I guess the next step that I talk to them about is seeking a mentor or seeking a colleague. And I'm aware that psychiatrists and psychologists all need to have a clinical supervisor or someone who they debrief with at a regular point in time for their mental health.
Yep, whereas, very much part of the practice.
Yeah, the general medical profession don't.
Really?
It's quite surprising.
That is surprising because it's so much part of our profession. It's so much part of the norm, and I wouldn't have thought that it should have been that different. I mean, I know that the emotional, well, nice even that, you know, psychologists deal with some really emotional stuff, but clearly doctors are dealing with really emotional stuff too. That really surprises me. I did not know that.
Exactly. I really think that would be a wonderful step to move towards, even if, because it's very hard to implement these big grand changes, even if it wasn't at the whole level that everybody needed a clinical supervision person, that they had someone they could talk to at a regular basis about difficult things, whether that be a colleague or a mentor or someone more senior than them, ideally in a clinical supervision role, but before that, just having someone that they can bounce feelings and thoughts off and not having to manage it all in their own head is really important.
Yeah, I mean, that's something we talk about even in workplaces in completely non-related fields, is the importance of having a mentor or having somebody, you know, having a manager, say, who you can just debrief with when you've got tricky situations.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, even at an organisational level, I would have thought that would be the kind of thing that could be addressed, although you might not be able to change it quite yet at a systemic level, at least at an organisation, you know, within clinical teams, to say this is now part of our practice that we sit down and debrief whether, and as psychologists, we have peer supervision as well as a model of, you know, sort of more mentorial or more senior person, more experienced person. So even then, just using that as an opportunity to just go, oh, I just had this really difficult situation this week and I wasn't quite sure how to deal it, and this is what I did, and what do you think, and, you know, how could I do it differently next time, or has anyone else even just been in the same situation? It's just a really useful conversation to have.
Yes, and especially about the non-clinical things. So the clinical decisions are often quite black and white, lots of grey, but yes, the correct clinical decision was made, or no, we would do something differently next time. But all of the non-clinical, the thoughts and the feelings and the communication that have happened is often what's as equally, if not more important to debrief on.
Even just be able to say, oh, my God, that was a really hard conversation I had to have with a parent or a spouse or a patient themselves, and to have other people say, you know what, that they are really difficult conversations and it does affect you, and that's just, you're human.
Yes.
A reminder that you're human. So supervision as a model or a practice, asking for help, are there any other key things that individuals can do that you feel will help?
They're my main two I talk to people about. There's lots of self-care that we can talk about as well, but I think that as a whole, doctors do that quite well. They probably let it slip when they should continue doing it, but they do,
don't we all,
normally do it quite well, but they're my big ones.
And where else could people find out more? I will pop some of, I've put some articles about your research, both the academic articles and also some press articles just for people who are interested. You mentioned there was an article in the MJA, which is the Medical Journal of Australia. Is that right? Am I getting that right? Yep. Regarding just that kind of senior doctors looking after more junior doctors. Are there any other key resources that you think would be helpful to anyone who's listening who wants to find out more?
Always. I love resources. So each state-based health service and each training college are going to have their own policies and programs around doctors' health and well-being. So specifically for people in the medical field, if they're unsure or uncertain, that's where I would send them to start. So it's either to their state-based health service, their hospital they're working for, or their community practice they're working for, or their registered college that they're a part of. For instance, with that, at the RACGP, the Royal College, Australian College of General Practice, the New South Wales branch ran a wellbeing weekend earlier this month, where we actually got together with a group of GPs across their careers and talked about things like identifying personal values and goal setting and how to manage those difficult conversations around end-of-life care specifically. But then also things like having a hobby, and we taught knitting and creative writing and
all my favourite things. And
yeah, all of those really important things. And they're done Australia-wide at lots of different colleges at different levels and involvement, but there are some really good opportunities coming through. For non-doctors, I think Beyond Blue is a great place to start, and they have their survey free and publicly available. And then for anybody who has any worries about stress or burnout in themselves or their loved ones, I usually would get them to talk to their GP about strategies and resources themselves, and make sure that all doctors have their own GP. And if they're unable or can't get in to see their own GP, then Lifeline is a really good resource as well.
And we often refer people, even in workplaces or in, you know, in any domain, as psychologists to GPs, because it is the first port of call to be able to get then a mental health care plan, which then allows you access to a psychologist under Medicare, so bulk billing, which is very, very helpful to a lot of people. Rebecca, thank you so much. It's been such an interesting conversation, and I think we can have another conversation down the line about doctors and motherhood, because I think even if for people who are not doctors or in the medical profession themselves, I can only imagine there will be very similar themes for professional women who are trying to juggle all the things, and I know that's certainly the case for a lot of our listeners. So we can have that conversation further down the line. But I really appreciate your insights today and all those resources. I will put links in the show notes to yourself, your research, all the things that we've mentioned. And we'll have you back on to chat again soon, maybe.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Rebecca Hoffman exploring burnout, well-being and self-care for our junior doctors. And if you're keen to learn more about Rebecca's research, her tripartite model for risk of burnout in junior doctors, or some of the support services that she mentioned, links to all of these can be found in the show notes for this episode at potential.com.au/podcast. And we've also included the links to Rebecca's website, her podcast, Just a GP, and her tips for keeping well as a junior doctor. As I mentioned in the intro to today's episode, we will do special requests here at the Potential Psychology Podcast. I love hearing from you. And if you have a topic that you'd particularly like me to cover on the podcast, please get in touch. You can email me at ellenjackson@potential.com.au or drop me a line via Facebook or Instagram or our website, whatever works for you. And I'd also love it, as I ask every week, if you could give the Potential Psychology Podcast a rating or review in iTunes, as these ratings make it easier for our podcast to be found. And that means that more people are hearing from our experts, and together we're helping more of us to thrive, flourish and fulfill our potential. And there's a link that takes you straight to iTunes and where to leave a review on our podcast page at potential.com.au/podcast, or hit write a review at the bottom of the podcast page on Apple Podcasts or your Google Podcast app, whichever you use. So, what topic will we be exploring next week? Well, my guest is Callie McKenzie from Kid Proof Food, and we are talking about life as an allergy parent. So with an increasing number of children in the Western world being diagnosed with sometimes life-threatening food allergies, parents of these kids can find themselves really overwhelmed, anxious, and sometimes unwell themselves. And Callie knows this from firsthand experience, but also, as a trained doctor herself, she has some great insights to share that I know will actually help all of us, allergy parent or not. And here's Callie to tell us a little bit more.
Acknowledge to yourself, this is hard. It's not what I expected. It's not what I would have chosen for my child. But I also do need to find a way through this. With food allergies, it's always much easier to feel in control and comfortable when you have a degree of order around how you're going to do food, whether that be organising your pantry in a certain way, whether that be, you know, meal planning, whether that be going to the supermarket with our kids and, you know, reading labels. Because if you're constantly having to read a label every single time you're reaching for a snack, or trusting that the babysitter will remember to read that label or whatever it is, that's just going to go over and over in your mind in the background. And so, you know, it's always just going to increase your anxiety levels. And then I would say, just acknowledge that this is a marathon, not a sprint. And you do need to find ways that are going to help you manage that. For me, I don't think I could do this without the sleep, eating, exercise piece, and then the meditation and yoga has been huge for me. But then the social connection, as much as you want to retreat and stay safe, find like-minded people, reach out for that help. You don't have to reinvent the wheel yourself.
That is next week in episode 44 of the Potential Psychology Podcast. As always, thank you so much for listening. It's great to have you here. Let me know what you've enjoyed today. I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me a line, as I said earlier, at any time at ellenjackson@potential.com.au. Have a fabulous week, and I look forward to talking to you soon.